It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2021, returning MOI Global Instructor, Christopher Carlin, Chief Investment Officer of Aquitania Capital Management. Chris has been in the investment business since 1991. Prior to founding Aquitania in 2012, Chris held positions as a research analyst and portfolio manager at First Pacific Advisors, Kestrel Investment Management, and Fairview Capital Investment Management. Chris interned with Farallon Capital Management while pursuing his MBA. He began his career with Wells Fargo Nikko Investment Advisors, which later became a part of BlackRock. Chris received his BBA from the University of Wisconsin in 1990, his MBA from Yale in 1998, and has held the CFA designation since 1994. Always a pleasure to have you with us, Chris. I've truly enjoyed your past presentations and very much look forward to this one today. I'm going to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. Happy New Year, and Happy New Year to everybody on the conference. John's always a pleasure to participate in these events. We've made some great connections, got some profitable investment ideas, and made some very nice relationships with you and the other participants. So it's always a pleasure to be here, and thank you again for the opportunity. I'll start talking today. As you can see, the idea we're presenting is BP. And just a quick bit about us. We're a long-biased global investor. We sort of have evolved into increasing the amount of focus I spend on looking at quality names and long-term compounders. But your origin is really as an opportunistic value manager, and incorporate that into the investment approach that we follow. And so onto the idea, BP. So BP, legacy British Petroleum, it's trading around $25 a share. It's a legacy oil company transitioning to carbon net zero over the next 30 years by 2050. What BP, consists of is substantial oil reserves that are at the lower end of the global cost curve. They have a global retail distribution, significant emerging markets presence, and they already have significant low carbon investments in biofuels, solar, wind power, things like that. But they've come to the realization that, the world is transitioning to a post-oil world. It's going to be a very slow transition, but it's ultimately, one that they want to be in front of that transition curve. So currently the business has a $84 billion market cap, $150 billion enterprise value. It has never, reached the highs or surpassed the highs that it had prior to the Deepwater Horizon accident back in April 2010. It has shrunk considerably since then. Most of the liabilities from that incident are behind them at this point. The value drivers here are they are going to be deleveraging their balance sheet. The transition to a low carbon will improve and stabilize returns, which we think that stabilization combined with being a sustainable provider, should warrant a premium. And that's sort of the long-term thesis. What's really interesting, I think, about BP right now is, and this is Best Ideas 2021, not Best Ideas 2050. There's a short-term opportunity, and last year, it's been one of the more challenging market environments that I've seen in my career. And as we've transitioned the business, as we've adapted, to look more at global compounders, you know, you're starting to move up a valuation curve. And, you know, the there's the Charlie quote, the Munger quote, of, you know, so I own assets I would never buy at their current prices, but I'm quite comfortable holding them. And we sort of found ourselves in the same place that, you know, it's an exuberant market. It is being artificially stimulated by cheap money. And, you know, it's a question of to what extent are you participating in that? And to what extent are you going to, you know, balance out your portfolio? So, you know, as we got through the summer of last year, I was looking for, you know, sort of inexpensive hedges, inexpensive protection put on the portfolio. And, you know, what are the options? So one option would be to short names. And, you know, we certainly didn't want to get into a position where we were, you know, long value and short, you know, growth. That is essentially not hedging anything, but it's doubling your directional bet. And we didn't want to be in that position. Certainly there's the opportunity to buy, you know, put options on indices. Didn't think that was cost effective. And there's also the maintenance costs in maintaining hedges like that. So, you know, every investor will have to face this question, and you know, how they answer depends on you know, their own capabilities, temperament, their clients, and whatnot. But for me, what I was looking at was, you know, a way to sort of insulate the portfolio to give me more comfort in holding names that had, you know, run up significantly due to the, you know, conditions coming, you know, out of the, you know, we took the opportunity with, you know, in the spring when the market was crashing to do what we typically do during that period, which is to go to the, you know, the wish list of companies that you would like to own, but at prices that are below, you know, what had been typical. And we found that opportunity. So we rotated into increasing quality of the portfolio, and were, you know, rewarded for that far earlier than I expected, which was fortuitous, but it left, you know, position of being, you know, long, you know, names that were really expanding in valuation with the backdrop of, you know, a world that was still, you know, very much in turmoil and out of sync with what was happening in the equity markets. And so the question is, well, how could we best protect the portfolio without, you know, allowing us to maintain this exposure? And so what I came on was the idea of looking at oil companies. The, you know, and historically, you know, commodity businesses are not where I'm looking to invest. But I thought oil in particular presented interesting opportunity because, one, it's, you know, priced in dollars around the world. So it's a play on weakening, you know, dollar based on the inflation of the money supply. And that's played out and probably will continue to be a factor. Second is, you know, you had demand was, you know, dramatically reduced, suppressing oil prices. A lot of production capital and capacity had been shut in last year. So there was, you know, if you're playing a reopening trade, you know, as demand increases, it's reasonable to expect that oil prices will increase with that. And possibly very sharply because of the fact that there's going to be a lag before production capacity will come back online. So, you know, and on top of that, you had an industry where the valuation multiples had gotten very low because of a variety of factors. One is, you know, people rotating out of energy, either for ESG reasons or just because, you know, the action in the market was elsewhere. So I thought, you know, the cost to the portfolio of holding BP was lower than any other hedge that I could think to put on. And so, you know, we started getting involved last summer when it was around, you know, the high teens, low, you know, 20. And then in the fall, it dropped down to like 15. And, you know, that made it very interesting. It's trading about 25 now. It's gone up a fair bit in the last, you know, 2 months. And it's provided an interesting bounce to the portfolio that you have. You know, on days when there's been market weakness, there's often been, you know, boost in the stability that BP has brought to the portfolio. So there's a sector rotation. You know, if you look at people going out of growth into value, that also would benefit in the short term. So in the short term, we find it very attractive, you know, partially because of its own merits. It's a very cheap asset, throwing off a fair amount of cash flow. There's some near-term catalysts with deleveraging the balance sheet, but its primary value I see in the near term is really in providing a hedge to allow for the rest of the portfolio to be, you know, remain invested in stocks that are maybe at elevated valuations. The long-term opportunity is driven by a transition, you know, from an oil company to an energy company. And where I think this is interesting, you know, aside from the, you know, the benefits that the planet would have, but from a strictly financial perspective, if you're an oil company, you know, you have, you know, the one factor that really determines your returns is outside of your control, and that's the price of oil, and it's a volatile price, and it's one that's not controlled by the company. And that is, you know, what warrants such low multiples for oil companies. But if you're transitioning to an energy provider, which ultimately is an electricity provider, a low carbon, you know, source of electricity, these are far more stable projects. And considering the amount of capital investment that goes into these projects, A, that's a barrier to entry because there's only so many firms that can raise the capital to put, you know, wind farms up in the North Sea or to, you know, do a large biomass project in Brazil or to do, you know, hydrogen project in China. And, you know, BP has a global footprint. They have relationships with all levels of government from national down to municipal. And they have the balance sheet and the technical expertise to, you know, manage and deploy large-scale infrastructure projects. But as you get into, you know, being a, let's say you're an electricity provider, which could very well end up being a regulated business, you know, you are earning, you're earning higher returns, but you're also earning stable returns. And that stability, you know, aside from the fact that it's sustainable, which we think also deserves a premium, but just the fact that it's stable and at an elevated level, that warrants a premium. So you could see, you know, over the course of the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, you know, BP shrinks probably on the top line, but, you know, ultimately grows in profitability. And the volatility of those profits is sharply reduced, and that likely warrants an increased multiple. You know, electricity providers trade at, you know, about 10 times EBITDA, where, you know, oil companies probably right now are trading around, you know, 5 to 6 times. So we think that ultimately over time, that's there is an opportunity for a substantial re-rating on the stock. And, you know, talking about sustainability, you know, there's a quote here from a former minister of oil of Saudi Arabia, you know, Stone Age didn't end for lack of stone, and the oil age will end long before the world runs out of oil. And, you know, I think we've reached that point where, you know, the world and investors in particular are looking, you know, beyond oil. At the same time, oil is going to be with us for a very, very long time. And it's going to continue to be a large source of energy. And, you know, I think what will happen, my own personal belief, is that ultimately, you know, what's going to end up controlling the supply of oil will be more on the regulatory front And then at some point it becomes a question of, you know, to what degree are capital providers going to maintain a willingness to invest in oil projects? And so if you have, you know, regulatory constraints and capital constraints, you could very well see a world that as we transition away from oil, that it's that the price of oil does not fall, you know, to zero, but rather actually rises up to a significant level because of you know, external constraints on capacity expansion that you know, might make the last, you know, decades of oil be still very profitable for companies such as BP. And because they're at the low end of the cost curve, you know, they're expected to probably be around till close to the end of oil. And that oil is providing the cash flow, providing the balance sheet that can finance this transition. So as a result, we think, you know, BP is actually, you know, if you're looking at ways to invest in a sustainable energy future, you know, BP, you know, is probably does not have the highest return potential, but it certainly, I think, has one of the lowest risk profiles to get that exposure. So why BP? You know, the European majors seem to be more focused on transitioning to a low carbon future than the US majors do. And you have BP, Shell, you know, Eni. BP has a global scale to effectuate change, low cost reserves, global distribution network, large trading operations, significant relationships with governments around the world, and there's material emerging market exposure, which is going to drive growth. You know, they have through their convenience, as an anecdote, you know, through their convenience store, you know, retail operations, they have a presence in China, and they're rolling out like EV charging at these locations. And China right now represents about half of the world's installed base of electric vehicles. So, you know, they have the infrastructure that's already in place that they can leverage upon to drive growth and adoption of these new technologies. What is unique to BP is BP owns just under 20% of Rosneft, which is the Russian oil company, which, you know, trades at you know, substantial reserves, trades, you know, rather low multiple as well. You know, it's got about $14 billion market value is BP's stake. And this is of a company that has a, you know, 150 billion market cap. So it's about, you know, 9-10% of the enterprise value is represented just by the Rosneft stake. Rosneft pays out half of their cash flow in dividends, which has ranged between, you know, $500 million to $1 billion a year in dividends that goes out to BP. So they have, you know, substantial oil exposure and cash flow that comes to them annually without having to make any commensurate capital investment. And so I think that's really the swing factor that led us to BP over, say, you know, Royal Dutch Shell, which is also, I think, you know, merits investigation investment. So just go quickly through some of, you know, the BP's slides to give an overview of the business. You know, so they're going to be organizing the company in sort of three focuses. You know, on the hydrocarbons, they're going to do a substantial divestment of, you know, about $25 billion over the next few years, half of which I think has already, you know, been in negotiation. And, you know, there's going to be a more focused portfolio there. They're going to cut, you know, CapEx down to about $9 billion a year for hydrocarbons, down from, you know, about $16-17 billion. So that will be, you know, there'll be continued, probably look at about a 40% production cut over the next, you know, decade or so on the hydrocarbon side. Convenience and mobility, which also includes, you know, their refining operations, which are substantial. And the refining operations probably present one of the biggest upsides to earnings for them. Refining margins have been suppressed because of lack of demand over the last year from the pandemic. But you have convenience, mobility. You know, they have a retail presence in, I think there's about 8,000 locations across the world. And then their low carbon electricity and energy portfolio, you know, that is going to be, you know, where they're going to be growing. And I think by 2025, about 20% of their capital base is going to be, you know, in those projects. Just to show, you know, again, the transition that they have on the low carbon side, you know, I think what's important here is to see that, you know, these areas in which they're growing are not new areas to them. They already have a presence there in renewables, in LNG, in biomass, in electricity trading, and they're simply building on that. So extending and deepening their current capabilities, you know, we think for a company like BP is relatively low risk. Certainly, you know, it very different comparison to say, you know, company that's starting from scratch and is trying to enter these markets with the new technology. This is all sort of established tech, established projects that are just being increased in scope and scale. Financially, you know, they're looking at you know, deleveraging. They cut the dividend last fall down to 21 cents a year. They're going to keep it there. And then, you know, above that for cash flow, they're going to be, you know, allocating to buybacks once they've hit their deleveraging targets. You know, they have $65 billion in net debt right now, inclusive of minority interest. They're going to deleverage that down to $35 billion, maintain an investment grade rating, and they're going to be reducing CapEx. What's interesting is, you know, the returns are going to improve. You know, the return on average capital employed is running about 8 or 9% now, and they're looking at taking that, you know, 12-14% over the next few years. And it's going to be both because they're going to be earning more stable and higher returns on these low carbon initiatives, but also largely because they're going to be employing a lot less capital to generate that cash flow. Here's for sort of reiterating that, you know, the low carbon spend, you know, they're going to be putting $4 to $6 billion per year into that while maintaining about a $9 billion CapEx spend for hydrocarbons. You know, here they, you know, their forecast when they announced this was in September of 2020, you know, before oil was really made the move that it's made over the last few months. So, you know, all of their cash projections are at $40 barrel oil. You know, I think it's, you know, we're already, you know, $10 over that and change today. And I think that is not unlikely to see the price of oil, you know, stabilize, if not continue to rise over here, particularly as, you know, the pandemic hopefully subsides over the course of this year and demand returns. And, you know, here they're looking at their EBITDA growth, you know, and I should add, you know, in fairness, they decided to benchmark to, you know, a period of second half of 19, first half of 20, which, you know, the polite word for that is sandbag. You know, that is a suppressed earnings number that they're growing from. To put it in context, the 2019 you know, EBITDA is really, I think it was like $37 billion. So, you know, we are talking about shrinking the business. It's not, you know, the growth that they're showing here is a little misleading, but, you know, the extent that they get to, you know, mid-30s, it pretty much is maintaining 2019 levels, but doing so on a lower capital base and with, you know, a greater stability of returns. They're going to also institute cost savings. I think they're already targeting, I think, $2 billion savings in 2021 and getting up to about $4 billion in annual savings over the next couple of years. This talking about where they're getting their savings from. And, you know, for a company that size, I mean, frankly, that's a pretty low savings target. Again, you know, showing how they're going to be using their cash. They've committed to paying this dividend, so that's locked in. It's a little under 1% yield right now, which, you know, isn't great, but you know, compared to what, you know, your cash balances are earning you, you know, is not an insignificant yield. And then again, the CapEx going to be 13 to 15 billion until they complete the delevering and then get up to about 14 to 16 billion a year with, you know, about 40% of that, 35-40% of that going into low carbon initiatives. And with the surplus that they have, you know, they're going to target repurchases. You know, it's arguably, if I think in their position, I would probably be focused on reducing reducing leverage. But you know, that's a shareholder friendly action that they're doing with the buybacks. And again, this is just showing again how they're going to do the buybacks. That you know, after they get you know, beyond their dividend, they're going to, and this shows with, as oil prices increase. So I think we could actually see them getting into, you know, a position of doing, doing buybacks, if not this year, probably starting next year. Again, the financial targets, you know, and again, these are, you know, $50 to $60 barrel, targets. You know, I think it's, you know, we're, it's not my job to predict oil prices, and it's not my job because I can't do it. But I would say directionally, it would. I think the risk is of, you know, more likely than not for oil prices to increase than decrease at this point. Let's go on. One of the things they're going to be doing this year is for they're going to change the reporting. To make it a little bit easier to break these things out. So the oil production, refining, convenience, gas, and low carbon energy will be together, and then corporate. So that'll make it a little bit easier, I think, for people to, you know, analyze their performance on the low carbon bit. And, you know, they're always going to get an oil company discount. They're always going to get a conglomerate discount. They're probably always going to get a large cap discount. But if you look at these low carbon initiatives and you compare it to any other, you know, pure play, you know, the multiples, even if you take a substantial haircut to the multiples on the pure play, you know, the value that they're creating on the low carbon side is significant. And so again, the financial summary, you know, you've got a dividend, you're going to be seeing, you know, surplus going to buy back, they're deleveraging the balance sheet, they're, you know, increasing returns, and those returns are going to be more stable. All this warrants a premium over time. So I think there's a very solid short-term story here, which we did, you know, disclosed initially as related to the value of BP as a hedge. And there's a long-term growth story of potentially a substantial re-rating as the sustainability and the stability of the revenues, you know, should earn a premium. Quick valuation, you know, again, $85 billion market cap, $150 billion enterprise value. You know, there's the value of the Rosneft stake. You know, if you want to be cute with this, you could always short Rosneft against your BP to make it less of a capital intensive play. I, you know, we're not doing that. You know, I don't really want to short a cheap Russian oil company, but it's traded in London. If you know, you're interested in doing that, and you know, these are consensus estimates. So if you look at you know, you can look at 2019 rather, you know, you're at about 37 billion in EBITDA. You know, that it's going to be a long time before they see that again, but they're going to be shrinking the capital base. And so the returns on capital employed, the stability of those returns will be increasing. Clearly 2020 is a very suppressed, year to benchmark off of, but you know, they should be doing, well, these consensus estimates are based on, you know, I think, you know, $40 to $50 oil. So there's definitely upside there. And then the question becomes, you know, this analysis kept the multiple relatively low and stable. The question is, at what point does the market say, hey, this company has, you know, has made a significant transition, it is part of the solution as opposed to simply being part of the problem, you know, it it warrants a premium. And it's nothing I can predict as to the timing or to the magnitude. But I think, you know, if you're looking at this as a long-term holding, I think that is really the core of the thesis. And at some point that, you know, there will be a substantial re-rating in the stock as it is recognized as being, having a, financial profile that is higher return, higher efficiency, and greater stability, and has a qualitative story of being, you know, perhaps, you know, it's not inconceivable to think that maybe some of the ESG funds will start looking and say, well, gee, you know, at what point do you look at this as an energy, a sustainable energy company, as opposed to, you know, a legacy oil company? But that's not something that's within my ability to predict, but I think it's also all upside. So, you know, with that in summary, you know, in the short term, I think it's a very attractive addition to a portfolio in terms of, you know, providing stability to a portfolio that may have, you know, some names that have, you know, stretched valuations but are continuing to execute that you don't want to necessarily liquidate. You know, adding BP has you know, proved to be a pretty attractive way and a very cost-effective way to hedge that portfolio. Long-term, it's, you know, it's a transition story that hopefully involves a significant re-rating over time. And so that's the that's our conclusion on British Petroleum. Hope you found the presentation valuable. Thank you.
Chris, thank you so much for the presentation. Clearly a compelling valuation case here. A question on that transition to alternative energy. Do we have a track record at all or any sense of what the returns on capital might be in that space?
Yeah, I think you're looking at returns that are probably, you know, north of 10%. You know, there might be, you know, with a stretch, you get into the 12, 14% range, you know. And I think what remains to be seen is, you know, electricity markets tend to be regulated markets. And, you know, that actually offers some advantages to them, I think, long-term. It is a big part of the re-rating story, because if you look at your, you know, experience as an oil company, you know, you can have some really great years and some really awful years. And those returns are outside of your control. You know, that volatility of cash flow, you know, warrants a low multiple. To the extent that you get into a situation where you're providing, you know, not only stable high returns, but possibly, you know, in many markets, a regulated return, which gives you, you know, recovery on your capital base. That, you know, it doesn't offer the upside that, you know, say, you know, some of these new entrants might be promoting, but it significantly de-risks the cash flow. And, you know, that's going to warrant a higher multiple.
And Chris, there's seems to be a generic criticism being leveled at the majors right now that basically they've been upping their leverage in order to maintain the dividend payouts. On that slide, you showed that BP doesn't need to do that. In fact, they can take down leverage a little bit. But do you think that sentiment is generally accurate for some of the other majors?
So First off, I should say, you know, I'm not an oil analyst. It's not an area we focus on. You know, I don't look at a lot of commodity companies, but, you know, anecdotally, I'll say that I completely agree with that statement based on my observation of particularly the U.S. majors. You know, Exxon is essentially a liquidating trust that has been, you know, buoyed up primarily by its presence in the S&P 500. You know, I think that story only finally started to crack last year. But if you look at like Exxon over the last decade, I believe Murray Stahl over Horizon had something like this in one of their letters where they say, look, you know, the revenues have decreased, the profitability has increased, the market cap has increased. Why? You know, and the only conclusion that really makes sense is because of its index representation. You know, those companies have absolutely levered up to, you know, protect the dividend and protect their investor base. You know, what happened in 2020, I think there was a confluence of events, but I think, you know, part of it is the pressure. If you look at like the European majors are certainly, I think, ahead of the curve in recognizing that, you know, the world is changing. I think it's also, you look at the influence of ESG funds and realizing that, hey, you know, you're being excluded from that. And that is, you know, you're sort of a financial pariah. And then of course you had the pandemic, which I think gave cover to a lot of the firms to change, to institute these bigger changes. So, you know, last year, I know Shell and BP dramatically slashed their dividends in late summer, early fall, and instituted new dividend policies going forward. And I think that was a smart thing to do because, you know, why hamstring yourself by paying out more than you should? You know, and your stock was already trading at pretty low levels. It's sort of the, you know, the kitchen sink approach to let's get all the bad stuff out and let's change our direction. And now, you know, as we rebuild, we'll rebuild with a shareholder base that, you know, comes into this not expecting that this is a big dividend play story. So I think for the Europeans, specifically, you know, Royal Dutch Shell and BP, you know, they are, you know, they've adjusted. In terms of Chevron and Exxon, I don't, you know, frankly know what they've done with their dividend policies, but I wouldn't be surprised. I know historically they've, you know, been paying out more than they really can afford to.
Right. I would totally agree that Shell and BP did the right thing because one concern is if the leverage really has gone up due to the dividends, that at some point they may just have to pump oil regardless of the price just to service that leverage, and that's not good for the market overall.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's you know, I think the mindset has changed. You know, if you think about what mattered to oil company investors, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was what was your ability to, you know, replace, you know, your production, you know, and at what cost are you replacing those reserves? The prism has changed. And now there's, you know, I think we're all looking at it and saying, listen, you know, your reserve report, what value does that hold if there's a very strong likelihood that those reserves are not all going to ever leave the ground, that they're going to be stranded behind? It goes back to that quote, you know, the Stone Age didn't end for lack of rocks. You know, there is going to be a point where, you know, the world will transition to other energy sources. Oil may still be around in some degree, and it will be for a very long time. I would imagine for the better part of this century, there will still be people pumping oil out of the ground, but it will be, you know, at a decreasing rate, and there's probably only at the end going to be a few people left. And so if that's now within the realm of not only possibility, I think that's within the realm of probability, then the question is, okay, so the terminal value of an oil asset could very well be zero, and it could be zero a lot sooner than we think, because if you can't pump that oil and your balance sheet is levered, then there's going to be a problem, because you know you're going to be in a situation where you can't cover your debt long before you run out of oil. And so, you know, I think for these companies, you know, it is a question of how do you reorganize to use the assets that you have. You know, you have a solid balance sheet, you have, you know, very good cash flow. You have the ability to divest other assets, and you have the ability, you have the technical expertise to develop these new services that are really an extension of what you've already been doing, but that are, you know, not only, you know, sustainable and better for the planet, but also have a better financial profile than your historical business. And the question is, how fast can you get there? Because at some degree, it is a race to outrun the obsolescence of oil.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, I will leave it there and would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you with their own thoughts or questions. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again. It's always a pleasure, and I enjoy seeing you virtually now, and I hope to see you in person in the not too distant future as well.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invitation. And yes, we're very much looking forward to when we can, you know, be in a room together and see our friends, you know, not through a screen. And to your point, I certainly invite any, you know, when seeing this to reach out. We're, you know, it's really been one of the highlights of participating in these conferences is the conversations that occur after the fact. So thank you again for the opportunity, and Happy New Year. Wish you all the best.
Likewise. Thanks, Chris. Take care.
All right, you too.